Welcome to the Inclusion First Podcast, where we amplify the stories of regular people practicing anti-racism in their everyday lives. Every single one of us has the ability to create real and meaningful change right where we are. I'm your host, Carrie Sawyer, and I've got the stories to prove it. I can't wait to introduce you to these people, these change leaders, people who saw a need and decided to take action. To me, this is so inspiring, showing the powerful idea of everyday activism. I hope that you take away at least some small inspiration and use it to act and create more good in your world too. Let's get started, y'all. This episode of the Inclusion First Podcast is sponsored by the Social Justice Superhero Academy. In this four-day online course, you, aspiring changemaker, will learn how to start interrupting racism that is happening around you and start creating more inclusion and more equity in our world. Now, as part of the Academy, you'll get access to 4 one-hour video sessions, an interactive community space to share experiences and ask questions, workbooks, exercises, and guides to support you on your journey. Enrollment closes in early August, so sign up today at www.tinyurl.com/social-justice-superhero. Welcome to another episode of the Inclusion First Podcast. Today we have another incredible guest. So, you know, when you have like a friend or a work friend or an acquaintance is like, hey, you need to meet this person. And that happens a lot to us, right? And so sometimes you say yes, sometimes it doesn't work out. Well, our next guest is one of the times where it did work out. And I am so happy because she is such a gift and honestly, like a mentor. I want to be like Tina Dyer when I grow up in this DEI work. She is the founder and principal of Grafted Together Consulting, which she established in 2009. And this firm really exists to support executive leaders, individuals, and teams as they create spaces where truth and authenticity are welcomed, where creativity and innovation are unleashed, and where equitable and inclusive practices are normalized to create a sense of belonging where all people can thrive. I love all of those words, all of those ideals, so very much. Tina has a long list of receipts, and so I'm going to go through some of those just so you can get an idea of the breadth of like the person that she is and the values that she holds, just to let you know what kind of conversation we're about to get into. So Tina is a 32-year financial services professional, a leader in the area of global racial equity, diversity, and inclusion, a public speaker, learning and development professional who has been equipping leaders to engage in crucial conversations and talk about difficult subjects for more than a decade. She is a Courageous Conversations About Race practitioner and also is trained as a somatic abolitionist. She specializes in creating brave spaces where people can feel psychologically safe to engage, explore, and take action to achieve the outcomes that are important to them. She is a certified coach to the Intercultural Development Inventory and Inclusion Skills Measurement Assessments. She serves as a board member, trustee, and treasurer for Renovate USA. She is a workshop facilitator for Nehemiah Emerging Leadership Program and has volunteered as a career mentor for women's empowerment. She has a BA in psychology from UC Davis, a master's degree in Christian spiritual formation and leadership from Friends University. Tina is a National Speakers Association member. Tina is amazing. And we always have like those kind of conversations where afterwards you feel really full and like really relaxed. You can just go and let your hair down and say what's on your mind and just be totally supported and totally uplifted while you get to practice those skills yourself. And so I actually have never met Tina in person because we started developing our friendship during COVID, but I am so excited that she came into my virtual life and very, very excited to share this rich conversation with you. Please join me in welcoming Tina Dyer to the Inclusion First Podcast. Hello, Tina. Thank you so much for being here. Welcome to the Inclusion First podcast. I am so excited to have this conversation with you today.
Well, Carrie, like I've said to you many times, it's always great to connect with you. I appreciate and value the invitation.
Thank you. It is our pleasure to have you. Everyone, we're going to have a fantastic conversation. Tina, can you just tell everyone a little bit about yourself and then we'll just jump right in to the questions?
You know, I have always, over my whole life, been an advocate, right? So I was the person in the family who was making sure everything was fair. I was a person on the school ground who was looking, if somebody was sitting by themselves, I'm going to be the person to go sit with them because that, I don't want anyone to feel left out. And I'm sure that's connected to, you know, my life experience and all the family dynamics I grew up with. But I just have a heart for belonging for all people. And that's translated into the work I do and the communities I inhabit.
That's so beautiful. A heart for belonging. I love that. I mean, that's so much more than a t-shirt. That's like that's a mission. That's a life's calling, a heart for belonging. So beautiful.
What I'm excited about, because the word I learned this in the a recent program I finished, is, you know, exploring vocation, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, in our culture, we talk about jobs and careers. But, you know, in the past, people talked about vocation, where the essence of who you are was joined with a mission to be offered as a gift to others. And so living from that place, that's a whole different experience, right?
Oh, yeah.
Of, you know, I have to go and I have to and I have to, you know, I'm loving exploring the what I get to do, like getting to be here with you today. So that's a new way to frame that.
That's amazing. I mean, Tina's already dropping knowledge on us, so you can tell this is going to be a rich one. So I want to ask you this first thing. So what does it mean to you to be an activist in 2021? And the second part of that question is, do you consider yourself to be one?
You know, that's a big word, right? Like activist, right? I mean, when I hear a word like activist, I'm thinking about, you know, like Dr. Angela Davis. I'm thinking about Shirley Chisholm. I'm thinking about James Baldwin. And I like real clear that I'm not in that league of people. I mean, my goodness, right? And yet, in the spaces I inhabit, in the communities that I'm involved in, I am a person who is engaged, present, and learning and attempting to live with integrity so that my presence does mean I live out what I believe in wherever I'm at. And I have received feedback from people that has an impact on them. And so in that way, I am an activist.
I love it. And, you know, I wonder if some of these people, some of these names that you named in and all the others beyond at the moment that they were in it would be like, oh yeah, no, I'm not an activist because such and such. Yeah. That is what that looks like. Right.
Yeah. You know, one of the things you talked about being an activist in 2021, one of the things that has brought comfort in a way I couldn't have imagined, you know, like reading someone like an Ida B. Wells, reading W.E.B. Du Bois or Frederick Douglass, these are the same conversations. So maybe what I wasn't aware of, because I've been socialized in the United States of America, was the long history of the same conversation. And so as I've had all of my questions and I've been able to go back and read some of these historical writers of people who look like us, I have just been, I don't know what the word is, relieved, comforted, or energized. This isn't a new conversation. It might be being had differently in this generation. And so now I see myself as joining in an ongoing conversation that's been happening, right? And so now it's about my place in the long-standing conversation. And I think, you know, that's the invitation for all of us. our generation is joining an ongoing conversation that's been going in this country. And so what's my responsibility? What's our responsibility in this generation to do our part to keep that conversation going so that, you know, like our responsibility of this generation to keep that going? I get so excited and thrilled about just thinking about that.
I love the reframe that you did there because, you know, we'll have these conversations like nothing changed. We're saying the same thing over and over again, blah, 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 which is a much more I get it. It's a negative way to look at it. But what you're saying is we're joining into this ongoing conversation, which means we're joining, following in the footsteps of all these incredible people and taking their work and carrying it forward. And what is our responsibility in that? Mm-hmm. How does that provide us with direction and motivation and upliftment when we need it? Versus the frustrated, downtrodden feeling that you experience when you're like, oh, nothing's changing. We're saying the same thing, right? It's a totally different thing, totally different experience, totally different opportunity. So I love what you did with that.
Oh my goodness, Carrie, thank you. And think about this, Carrie, some of those people died so that we could have the benefit and privileges that we have. They were willing to put their whole being on the line for those of us who weren't even born yet.
Mm. Wow. It's powerful and makes it so clear and unmistakable, like what we need to do next, right? I mean, whatever that is, whatever you're being called to do, we're all in different places, situated in different groups and experiences, but clearly taking that torch and carrying it forward, whatever that looks like, is really the only option when you think about it like that. The only opportunity, the only privilege.
I was thinking great analogy since we're coming up with the Summer Olympics, right? Like this is the mm-hmm. baton passing, right? Yeah. And what did we not mention, right? Like what that we would be talking today, June 18th, 2021, right? Yeah. You know where I'm going, right? I can hardly even get the words out. I'm so excited. A national Juneteenth holiday. I mean,
yeah,
that's a really good summary for what we were just talking about, right?
Yeah, it's huge. And I totally wanted to bring this up like almost next even. So thank you for mind melding with me on that. And, you know, I had some mixed emotions about it, not because of commemorating, you know, the freeing of the Texas slaves and that being the end of, you know, the official slavery and everything beautiful that came from that, but more from the, like, how does this help us in this moment? And is it the best thing to do? And what's the whole plan that, of course, I don't have visibility into? So I would love to talk with you about your reactions and your excitement and unpack that a little bit, because this is anti-racism work for sure. And when how we show up, how we support, how we talk about and socialize this new and historic moment and thing. You know, this is the second federal holiday or the first federal holiday since MLK Day was made a federal holiday, right? So it's been a minute since one has come into existence, and to have this one given to African American people in the United States and everyone else to learn from and commemorate and experience and celebrate. I mean, that's a big deal, like regardless of anyone's motivations or what the plan is, like just in and of itself, it's huge.
Yeah. Thank you for calling out. I think if I were to summarize what you said is this is complex, right? So, and it just happened. So I just want to own and be transparent and say how I feel about it today might not be how I feel about it next week, right? What I'm connecting with is the idea again that there is an acknowledgement that people have been fighting, dying, writing, you know, for there to be. And so I think the acknowledgement is what I'm holding on to and really lifting up. And yes, we just have mixed motives and intentions and I've already seen some, you know, co-opting of, you know, how we're going to, people are using this for, you know, industry or business. And I'm like, wow, are we just going to turn this into, you know, a trinket set? I mean, that took like 30 seconds. It's almost like after the, you know, what do you call that? The Super Bowl and the shirts and the, everything is out. Like, it was like, are we going to just turn this in? But that, you know, that speaks to part of our culture. And it isn't. And again, I think of this is a 400 year plus problem that we're leaning into. And so there isn't going to be one thing we can do, one action we take, one statement we make, one holiday that's going to resolve everything. And yet that doesn't mean we don't do anything. So I think it'll serve a purpose. There's good that can come from it. There's some people who will exploit it, co-opt it. That's just part of our culture. But I do wonder, how can it serve to move conversation forward or broaden conversation? Because if I think about what I feel is our challenge, our biggest challenge is we can't talk about it, right? I mean, the fight going over what is the history? What can we tell, right? And how history, our history, you know, African-American history in particular, has been erased, ignored. So, in that respect, I agree it's not enough. But if I could tell you honestly, what was my first thought when I heard it? I was like, awesome! And now we need to have Columbus Day renamed to National Indigenous People Day. And I thought, now, isn't that something, right? You just got something. You're already asking for something else. But it is my ask. I think a great follow-up would be for Columbus Day to be renamed National Indigenous People Day. And I don't know who I need to write to talk about that.
I'm sure that there'll be lots of opportunity, lots of different people hitting that from different angles. And, you know, I love what you said, because everything that happens like sparks new interests, new desires, new ideas, and even like opening up conversations that have never happened before, right? Like, hey, what is this day? Why do we get it off? Like, and then all the questions that come from that, because like, why was it that Texas waited so long? Like, where else does that happen in our history? Like all of these different things, right? That wouldn't be available necessarily in the same way without a day like Juneteenth. So I think that your question of what good can come from this, there's obvious stuff, but then how do we even push that forward to really use it to get even more benefit and to launch into different directions that, you know, not having it wouldn't have shown us.
So here's I did this last year on my out of office, which I don't have to do this year because that's changed, but I will be out of the office celebrating Juneteenth. And I put a link to a site. Right. So everyone who reached out to me received that message, and I was able to do that. Well, now it's a national holiday, so organizations, but I was with talking with a friend who does not have any awareness about Juneteenth. And I said, have a great Juneteenth weekend. He says, you know, I've been hearing about that. What is that? Boom, sent some message. And right. So,
yeah,
it there you go. Brilliant. There's an example.
Visibility, conversations, opportunities for human connection. And that's what this is all about.
And this is someone that I've been in that I've known for about 4 years, and we've been in conversation. And so there's relationship. I think providing information in relationship is very different from providing information randomly to, hey, you should know this, right? But allow me to share. Yeah. So.
Yeah. And the openness of both parties. And the grace that is given in that relationship, I think that that's super, super, super important. So, Tina, we are here talking about activism, talking about anti-racist work. I would love to have you share a little bit about the change that you are looking to create in this world, that you are working to create in this world, that is percolating inside of your amazing brain, and the vision that you have for, you know, for the work that you're doing.
It ties into what I shared before about our inability to talk about this topic of racism and anti-racism, in my opinion, able to talk about it well. So I am really focusing in now on creating brave spaces where we can talk about what we've been socialized not to talk about, or we haven't been equipped with the skills to talk about well. That's actually where my passion is. And I think it comes from my experience as a workshop facilitator, a learning and development designer, that I understand that information doesn't bring transformation, but people need experiential learning. And if you think about how segregated people live, for some people, their first interaction with people that are different from them comes when they go away to college. At least that's what I heard from people in the corporate setting, that, you know, I grew up in this homogenous bubble. And when I went to college, I was exposed to all of these things, or when I came to work at this company. And so what I found in working in a Fortune 50 company is that, you know, these matters and conversations only needed to happen at work, because when they left work, they went back to a homogenous environment where there was no need to have these conversations. And look how the world has changed. Right. So now these conversations are coming up everywhere, and it's not so separated that, I'm safe at home to not have to deal with that.
Yeah.
Those of us, right? I'm African American, right? I've never had that experience, right? This is a part of my, right? I know you can relate to that, right? Like, this is a, we don't take off from the conversation, right? But the splitting of, you know, having community to reconnect and recharge, but having to, you know, walk in a, for me, having to walk in a corporate culture, you know, for me that, you know, I was code switching.
For sure.
Yeah. So part of what I'm doing is I will own, we talk in this anti-racism language, that I'm a recovering a simulationist, right? So I worked 32 years in a Fortune 50 company. I was socialized with white standards as normative and best. And so I internalized a lot of that. And so part of what my work has been is untangling all of that, you know, unhooking all of that. And then to think about a large part of my career was spent my being the only one or one of a few.
Right.
So I would call the cost of tokenism. So there's been, you know, so I've been in this a lot of internal work. And now I want to create the space where we can have all of those conversations. So some of those conversations are interracial. Some of those conversations need to be intraracial. And that's what I'm doing. I'll give you an example of that.
Please.
I think community is so powerful. And do you recall Ava DuVernay? She has so many wonderful works, but her series on When They See Us. Mm-hmm. Now, if you haven't seen that, that I think is should be required for all humans, especially if you're a United States of America citizen. But I knew that it was going to be difficult to watch. And so my thought was, I need to watch this in community. Mm. But then I said, I need to watch this in mixed community. So I have a pretty diverse community of friends, and we have lots of conversation. So I have, so there's two African-American women and two white women, and we watched When They See Us together. And so we watched it over, it was either two or three Fridays. We had dinner, we'd watch, and then we'd have dessert, because you need some dessert after that. I shouldn't be endorsing sugar. That's not helpful. But that was such a powerful experience. And it was helpful to my soul in ways that I would not have known. Mm. and the conversations we were able to have, and just the experiencing of it, being myself with people that I, you know, have relationship with. So we were able to talk about a lot of things that I don't know that we would have ever come up had we not walked through that experience together. And then guess what? There's been other invitations extended to, you know, travel in each other's spaces between the four of us. And so that's been an additional gift, right? But again, building community, I think, is really powerful. I don't know if I answered your question at all.
You did, and so beautifully. And I'm just like hearing all these examples of like Aunt Teresa's thought and action and belief and like cultivating like the connection and cultivating just really the like the skill set and the experience of it. Because, you know, it's more than like going to a march, and those are totally important. But it's bigger than this, and it's everyday actions. It's connecting with the people that are directly around you and having these meaningful and important conversations. And, you know, we might think as people of color, like, okay, this is really good because they're going to get to learn, but then we learn too. And I think that is the most beautiful part, as well. I took a anti-racism and storytelling workshop, and it was over 7 weeks, and it was a mixed race group. And there were times where we would do breakout sessions, mixed race. And then there were times where we would do breakout sessions, like people of color and white people did their own. And I thought it was super powerful to even think about it like that, because the host of this, Johanna Walker, she was like, there are some conversations that white people need to have with each other about this topic. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, I want to be in that room too, but like, I want to know what they're saying, but I get that because we know what it feels like to be in community. And the assumptions that I had even coming into this, that were kind of blown away, was just really interesting. You know, I do this work, we walk this walk, and still, you know, there's so many opportunities. Like every interaction really is an opportunity to drop a barrier, drop an assumption or a stereotype, and really open up to the fullness of human connection and the human experience. So I totally get it. And I love, thank you so much for sharing that story and giving just another powerful way that you can look around your world and, you know, create space for anti-racist movement, even in the most simple of relationships.
Well said. There's a quote that I will butcher. I'm not sure who it's from, but the gist of it was, you know, it's hard to hate up close.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Even strangers, when you're put into an environment where it's a safe space, right? Like this curated anti-racism workshop, the storytelling workshop that I took, it was a safe space. We all opted in to be there, to learn, to connect, to be vulnerable, right? So it's hard. It's hard to hate up close in those, in those close contacts where you're all open and all wanting to move in the same positive, light-driven direction. Okay, Tina, so I got another question for you. I mean, you have this like wealth and depth of experience, both in professional and personal, and just in how you walk the world. Like you can hear like the kind of person that you are. It like is like breaking in, seeping in, like lighting up this entire conversation. And so I think it would be really powerful for us to hear from you. What has been one of the most important things that you have learned doing this work? And you're so self-reflective and aware. I know there's a lot. So maybe give us some of the, a couple of the really important lessons that you have learned from walking this walk and working in this space. You can tell I'm a huge fan of Tina. I'm like, I'm team Tina. I interviewed a high school student yesterday. I'm like, I'm team Leah and I am team Tina too. I love it.
That's your superpower, Carrie. You're, you know, creating space for relationships, and you are brilliant at this. Yeah.
Thank you, Tina.
There are two things that I think are coming up for me as I reflect on that. I think that it's easy to have this unction to do and to jump in and to take action, right? But before I can execute well on external action with others, in my opinion, I think it's important to first do internal work that is going to allow me to be, to learn my own story, to develop my own understanding, to build muscle and capacity for me so that I can engage with others. And I just think that's hard work. You know, our eyes point outward mm-hmm. so that we can see that, right? But reflection is looking inward and sitting with what we find, which isn't always what we'd hoped, you know, and not to do this in such a way that we become narcissistic and self-absorbed. And, you know, that's not for the sake of, you know, just being introspective, but for raising self-awareness and increasing my capacity, right? Because if I don't know myself well, I think that's what happens when people get into these conversations, they get triggered.
Mm.
So many people are asking questions. How do I talk about this and not help people not become defensive? How do I, you know, share my thoughts and then, you know, manage how people respond to me? Well, you know, the reality is that's not your work. That's their work. And their reactions to you being present and fully yourself, whether that triggers guilt, overwhelm, intimidation, all that, that's their reaction. Now, I'm not talking about we walk around and be abusive in any way or harmful. I'm talking about speaking the truth in love, being authentically yourself. And if that creates problems for people, that's a reflection of their work. Mm-hmm. But if we only have the skill to look outward, we make it about the other person and not what's happening within me. So I think cultivating that habit or practice serves being able to engage the work. So that was the first thought, and being introspective. And then the second part is community, that it is important for you to have community to support yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, trying to be engaged in anything, right? You need community. So how have I set up communities of support so that I am not feeling like I'm carrying this weight on my own shoulder? The thought came back. One of the things that I'm working through, because I said I'm a recovering assimilationist, is I've been socialized as an African-American person, I think, in this white normative culture, that it's my responsibility. And I was taught this once I went to corporate America, it's my responsibility to make other people comfortable with me.
Hmm.
And, you know, some of that came in the language of this back in 1987, right? And someone said, okay, don't you all sit together, you know, why? Because that makes, you know, white people uncomfortable. Well, I just have to tell you that I have retired from that job that I got a paycheck from.
Hat off.
That I no longer see it as my responsibility, right? To manage myself in ways for white comfort. Now, I could say that, right? But actually, that's been socialized. It's a part of my body knowledge. So one of the things I'm doing for my own development is of somatic abolitionist training.
What is this? And where can I get the link?
This is a Rizma Menakem, My Grandmother's Hands. Education for Racial Equity. He has a program. And I decided to do that because basically our habits, they're not just in our, you know, mental thoughts, right? They're actually internalized and they manifest themselves in our body. And so as a result of that, I reflexively work to make sure that, especially in a corporate setting, that people are comfortable with me, especially white people who might be in positions of power to have an impact on my life, right? Or positional power, whatever that looks like. Well, I have to do some things to retrain myself from doing that. So the apologizing for some things that really don't require an apology, or prefacing some of my statements, in ways that disempower what I'm trying to say in order to create comfort. So again, this is not about being rude, harsh, or abusive in language, but it is about unlearning to dysfunctionally rescue other people from the work they need to do. Yeah. So anyway, I know it's getting a little too wordy, but
no, that was amazing. Yeah. I'm like putting a note to get that link. I will put that link in the show notes because so many of us people of color need have the opportunity to do that work. And even when we set the intention to not, you know, cater to white comfort, it's more than, like you said, it's more than just in your mind. Like your whole body is mm-hmm. like, that's like what you do, like viscerally at this point, that's what we do. So how to undo that and to walk more confidently in our own skill. And it's not about our confidence. It's about, I don't know, like being allowed to step back into our power, because we're not spending that energy trying to cater to someone else's power, you know?
Exactly. Well said, right? That I'm using my energy to be human.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, Tina. So I have one more question for you. You've given us so many amazing examples of what I consider to be anti-racist thought and action, and really just a deep grounding in compassion and empathy and connecting with people and doing the inner work. One thing that I didn't say when you were giving kind of the important lessons, like this idea of looking inward, I honestly think is number one, definitely the first thing that we have to do as we walk any social justice path, because there's so many things that we need to learn, unlearn, relearn before we go out and try to recreate the world. And if we don't take that step, we're recreating those same beliefs and same ideologies into the new thing that's supposed to be better, and it ends up being the same, right? So there's so much there, and I could have a whole podcast on doing the inner work. I appreciate you bringing that up and sharing that so beautifully for everyone here today. So one of the things that the Inclusion First podcast is here to do is to help people to see ways that they can start to take up social justice work, anti-racist thought, activism in their own way, in their own world. Tina, can you give people who are listening, who might be standing on the sidelines, who want to get involved but aren't sure how, what advice can you give them to help them take that first step or that second step forward onto the path of social justice, anti-racist work, whether that be internal or external?
What's coming up for me in this moment, and so I'll just offer this. I have been working through my own racial narrative. And I think that is helpful because we all have a unique experience. And the more that I understand my experience, I understand the dynamics of the, like I said, the context I'm living into. So for example, when you talk about what's my first racial awareness or my racial innocence, when did that happen? Often people reflect to an experience in their childhood mm-hmm. that they've never examined, understood, or reflected, but so much was taught and trained right in that moment. You learn so much. Mm-hmm. And so when we hear a lot of people saying, where was this happening? I didn't know about this. I wasn't aware that these things were happening. Well, the question becomes, well, how is it possible that you weren't aware of this? And the reality is, it's just I haven't had to give attention to it. Hmm. But here's my first racial awareness experience that I remember, that I can recall. Being in elementary school, I can tell you one thing I hated more than anything else. I hated when Roots came on television. Hmm. Because for that week in school, right? I'm in California, born and raised. And so I don't know what the diversity was like. I don't really remember, but I remember going to school and kids saying, "You're Kizzy," and pointing at me. And I can remember, like, I mean, I'm not I watched Roots because I knew what they were talking about, but I don't remember any conversation in family. But in that moment, when I was on a playground, someone's pointing and saying, that's who you are. Well, when I looked at Roots, what did I see? I saw people who were poor, who didn't speak well. And I can think that was the start of me beginning to distance myself from that identity. Now, I didn't have any conversation with anyone about this, but what did I learn? And what did I internalize? And so one of the things that's challenging for me as an African-American person is I live in a culture that tells me I'm not a part of it and I'm less than. And we internalize those messages at very early ages. And it gets reinforced socially. So I can see a link between what happened that day and ways throughout my life where there's crunch moments and I've actually, what I talked to you about, code switched at work. That was another way of stepping back from my culture, not bringing that forward. So how can I talk about what we're talking about today if I haven't looked at and been able to interrogate those and adjust those and actually release myself from the need, even seeing the need to do that?
Yeah.
So interrogate your narrative. What was your first experience? What did you learn from your family and specifically around race? What did you learn in your high school experiences, right? What are those significant events that have happened that made an impact on you, shaped how you saw yourself, how you saw others or your group of people in the world? Yeah. So start there and complete your story there.
That is, I mean, that's great. Everyone has a racial narrative, whether you think you do or not. Everyone does. And so starting to look at what that looks like and how it's impacting you today. And that is not a short or easy thing, but having the courage to do that is going to set you on a really on a positive path. I mean, eventually it might not be pretty at first, but hopefully we'll get to a good place where we can then consciously understand how we're making decisions and why and start to self-correct those versus being self-sabotage because we have all these beliefs that we don't even know are really running the show, right?
Right, right. And so to be able to embrace all of who I am and live authentically in the world is my gift to the world and the spaces I inhabited. What, you know, the great poem, right? No one wins when we play small.
Absolutely. So beautiful. Tina, thank you so much for being here today. Thank you for sharing your knowledge and your wisdom and your beautiful spirit. This was wonderful to me. Is there a place where people can find you, follow you, get to know more about the work that you're doing and that you're creating in this world?
Oh, thank you, Carrie, for having me. First of all, it's always a joy to be with you. And people can connect with me on LinkedIn. Tina Dyer on LinkedIn, you'll find my information there. I am launching some projects, but I'm just not quite there and able to communicate all of that. But when they launch, LinkedIn will be the place that people can find me. Thanks so much, Carrie.
Stay tuned, world. That's what I heard. Stay tuned because there's going to be some really big things coming from this amazing woman. So thank you, Tina. Thank you for listening to the Inclusion First podcast. We are always collecting and answering your most important questions on anti-racism. So if there's something on your mind, head on over to theinclusionfirstproject.org and click on Ask a Question. We'd love for you to give us your like, your share, your follow, and especially your review, wherever you find us. Thank you so much again for listening, and we will talk to you next time.